Welcome to another For Your Consideration, where myself and my good friend Luke chat about things that one of us or the other one have brought to us for our consideration. Last time, Luke chose the film, the most expensive European film ever made, which was Fifth Element, for us to revisit and come back to and have a bit of a chat about. So,
I see
hello,
you've done
Luke.
Your research.
Well, a little bit. I, you know, you open it up and that's the first thing anybody says about it.
Yes.
They all just go, most expensive European film ever. And you go, yeah, but...
Also, one of those films that was nominated for both Oscars and Razzies.
Yeah, which I'm sure we'll cover. See, that I didn't spot, but I can... After watching it these days, I can see why on both counts.
Yes. Yes.
So, right, Luke, hello. Glad you brought it. I'm starting out by saying I am glad you brought this back to the forefront and presented it and went, let's do this. So I am glad about that.
Okay.
But why did you bring it?
Well, so I think, as I said last time, I was at a formative age when I saw this film for the first time. So it came out in 97. I saw it on VHS, I guess the following year, as, you know, VHS tapes tended to come out the year after.
They did.
Back then. I saw it at a church group, weirdly enough.
Okay, so, that was not where I was expecting this to go.
No. So let me explain. So the church that I went to was a large, popular church near where I lived. And it had quite a lot of youth in it.
Were one of those youth.
And I was one of those youth, yes. So I'd have been 13, 14 at the time. And our rector he'd been in the role for 2 or 3 years. And they were like, we want to do some stuff for the youth. And the churches had these home groups for grown-ups where people would meet and do Bible studies and stuff. And they were like, we want to do this for the teenagers. And... these groups were run by people in their 20s, students or kind of young professionals. And they basically take a bunch of teenagers under their wing and we'd meet and we'd do Bible study and stuff. And then occasionally we'd do other things like watch a movie. And so that was the context in which we watched The Fifth Element. I think if my parents had known that that was the film, they probably would have objected. Given the sexiness of said film. But anyway, that's the context in which I originally saw it.
Big conversation we're going to have and have to have in a bit. Yeah.
It is. Now, I have the Blu-ray now.
Yep.
I never had it on DVD, so I'm not sure at what point I revisited it after that original viewing at 14. But I clearly liked it enough to get the Blu-ray, and I must have watched it 2 or 3 times since then. But I think it's always stuck with me because, you know, of when I watched it as a teenager. Because I guess a lot of the things about it, the science fiction aspect of it, you know, because I was already a big fan of Doctor Who, well into my Doctor Who fandom by that point. The sort of, certainly from my context, the sort of transgressive nature of it slightly appealed. And I was 14, so, you know, raging hormones probably played a part in that.
Indeed.
And I suppose the other thing, I knew Ian Holm as Pod from The Borrowers.
Ah, right, okay.
So a lot of people, yourself presumably coming to this, would have been like, oh, it's Ash from Alien, right? I'm guessing that was your touchstone for Ian Holm when this came out. But for me, it was like, yeah, it's the guy from The Borrowers. And I loved him in The Borrowers because he was...
having a callback to things we've done in the past, it's the guy from the thing with the running, Chariots of Fire.
Yes. Yes, and as we said, I would have seen Chariots of Fire by this point, but I didn't think I made the connection between the guy in Chariots of Fire and Pod from The Borrowers. I don't think I made that connection until much later. So for me, it was like...
I've never seen that version.
Of The Borrowers?
I've never seen the BBC adaptation of The Borrowers.
It's good. I rewatched two or three episodes of it recently, and it held up. And it's also scored by Howard Goodall of Red Dwarf fame. Because I was watching it going, this sounds very much like Red Dwarf Series 5. And then I was like, oh, it came out at the same time as Red Dwarf Series 5 and was the same composer.
So there was that familiarity
of like him. And I know he's not the, obviously he's not the protagonist, because the film revolves largely around Bruce Willis, but he's got a really big role in it.
Much bigger than I remembered.
Yes. So I guess I liked him. But yes, I mean, it's just, it's colourful and loud and silly with a nice sci-fi story in it. And I guess, you know, I watched it with a bunch of other guys. I think we all liked it. I don't remember much discussion about the film afterwards, but it's just one of the things that stuck with me. I've watched it a few times since. I had the Blu-ray. I thought, let's bring it to Michael, because I didn't know, given the half-generational difference between us, whether you'd seen it and what difference that would have made to your experience of the film. So when did you first come across the film, Michael?
I saw it at the cinema.
Right.
I think, and I've cast my mind back now, I think I saw it with my mate Julie. Now, there'll be a reason I went with my mate Julie, apart from the fact that I'd known her since I was like 12 or something. But we both liked films, and it was just easy, and she lived around the corner, so we would kind of just go. And I think it was either when Virgin Cinema was running a kind of, you get a season pass, and mm-hmm. you can go as many times as you want over the summer. Or, and this is where I think it was, Warner Brothers Cinema, because at night it was free parking, and it wasn't too far. Right, so Warner Brothers is where I've got a memory of seeing it at. And I remember seeing it. Now, she would have insisted we saw it because it had Bruce Willis in it.
Right.
And she'd been a big Moonlighting fan, as was everyone of my age. Although I, of course, like Mr. Pesto, but we'll leave it there because you were supposed to like the other characters. But obviously, I am a Doctor Who fan, and therefore we like the periphery characters in all TV series, never the people who you're supposed to like. Anyway, she was a Bruce Willis fan. We'd go and see it for that reason. And it's sci-fi, you know, always good to see another slightly different sci-fi film. So now I'm thinking it's around the same time, possibly, as was it the Stargate movie around this time? So there was some smattering of sort of fairly expensive sci-fi happening.
So Stargate was 94.
All right, so that would
and
be
then
much
that,
earlier.
The team that made Stargate then did Independence Day in 96.
Right.
The film that did come out at this around about this time was Men in Black.
Ah, yes.
And I did see Men in Black at the cinema.
I saw that twice. Yeah. The first time I saw it, and the second time I saw it with my dad in a really bad cinema, and I was violently ill afterwards with the amount of dust that was coming off the chairs. I remember that asthma attack.
I know exactly when I saw the Men in Black, because it was the day after Princess Diana died, and it was a training day from school. So it was right at the
beginning. Are you sure that was Men in Black 1?
That was the first Men in Black, yeah.
Around the... That can't be right.
September 1997. I think she died on the 31st of August, I think it was. And I then
Went... Yeah, because I remember the Sunday morning that followed. But let's just...
But anyway, I then went to see... So Fifth Element would have come out in the summer, I guess just before.
This is so much easier to do. Yeah. So what we've got is the Paul McGann film.
Yes.
And then we've got this.
Yes.
There we go. Stay on brand.
Yeah. So 1996, Paul McGann film, Independence Day, summer blockbuster. 97, Fifth Element, summer blockbuster.
I think it was
summer. It premiered at Cannes, and they spent a lot of money, apparently, at Cannes.
Yeah.
And apparently it immediately divided critics. Some thought it was great, and others thought it was terrible. And it seems that there isn't really a middle ground. I think you either
really
enjoy it or you really hate it. And well, I don't know. Maybe you're going to be the one that treads that middle path of finding the good and the bad.
Well, I think younger me, the person who you spoke to last time, was very enthusiastic because I'd not seen it for ages.
Right.
And I was like, yeah, because I bought it on VHS.
Right.
But I never bought it on DVD, like you.
Yeah.
I remember because I was a stickler for this. I bought it in widescreen. I remember that being a thing. So VHS with even less signal in the middle. But at the time, that was what you were doing. Oh, I'm going to get the full film, the entire effect.
Yes, just now, in very low resolution.
I may have bought it in some sort of bargain bin at some point on DVD, but I can't remember physically doing that. So I can't remember doing lots of rewatches because around this time there was the switch over to DVD of you know. So I was probably rebuying the important stuff, and then anything new I was buying on DVD at that point. So this was the big changeover in format at the time. So I remember enjoying it. I've got some nice memories of it. I remember Mila Jovovich, which I'm probably going to butcher her name, and I do apologize. I think this was the first time I'd seen her. Am I right in thinking she's the main person in, like, the Resident Evil films? You're not going to know at all, are you?
I do. I've never watched, apart from a short clip, which was grotesque, people getting sliced up by lasers in a tunnel. And I was like, I don't want to watch any more of this. But yes, no, she was the face of Resident Evil for quite a while.
Yeah, so this is... Yeah, I remember, because I did see all of those and played the games to death. So I was aware of her. But I'd seen her in this. Now she's in Run Lola Run.
That is Franka Potenta, who then went on to be in the Bourne Identity.
Okay.
But so similar hair. It's probably what you're thinking.
What am I thinking? Oh, they all look the same. That's not what the French actors. Do European actresses all look the same? Probably that's a bad thing to say. But you know, that's fair enough. Okay, so.
But she was 19 in this, apparently.
That's just dodgy, right? Because after this... Oh, hang on. Yes, you're right. I had done my research. Luc Besson.
Yeah.
We have to talk about his career in a bit as well. Because that's just weird. Yes. He's doing his career in reverse.
Yes.
Right. So he's done... And no, we'll deal with that. But anyway, he's at the... While this film's being made, he's seeing... according to the research I've done, and I could be wrong, please correct me, the person who is blue and who's a singer in this film, that's who he's in a relationship with.
He was married to her.
Yeah.
They got married when she was 16, and they had a baby straight away, which is dodgy.
Even more questionable than where I was going.
Yes. Okay, and then. And then he left her for Mila Jovovich.
Yeah.
And they were married for about 18 months before they then divorced. So he's been married four times. His most recent marriage seems to have lasted for like 20 years. But yes, he was like 30.
I think not marrying someone who's still in their teens might help.
So apparently the film, I haven't seen Leon, but Leon apparently the whole relationship...
Oh, that is a superb film.
Yes, but obviously the relationship between Natalie Portman and Jean Reno is based on the relationship between... Luc Besson and Mai Wan.
That's a shame. I'll never ever watch that.
I'm sorry,
film
that's going to break it. And obviously that's where his work with Gary Oldman, and then Gary Oldman gets a film called Nil by Mouth, funded by Luc Besson, and then Luc Besson says, "I need you to be the villain in The Fifth Element," and Gary Oldman did it as he said to sing for his supper, and Gary Oldman hates The Fifth Element.
He did it. Well, I'd read that he'd done it as a favour.
He did it as a favour. Yeah. He did it. He the quote is, "I was singing for my supper," because Luc Besson had helped him get this film made, and then he was like, "You need to be the villain in this next picture."
Weirdly, this is the second day in a row someone's discussed Nil by Mouth, a film I've never seen.
No, Nil by Mouth.
I'm a gigantic Kathy Burke fan, and I was watching an interview with her yesterday, and she was talking about that and how it got made, and her part, her role in that, and that she became a movie actress, and she didn't really want to be a movie star, and I was just like, oh, Kath, because I've got a lot of time for Kathy Burke, so yeah, it's weird that the same film that you'd never think about for years comes up.
Yeah.
So my ex. Oh, go on.
So I guess. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know. Where do we start with the? Should we talk about the plot? We can talk about other issues that we might have, but I think one of the things that I like about it is that it's got a nice story. It's got a nice sci-fi story. You've got this kind of this priesthood that is preserving this story of this 5,000 year cycle. Evil comes when the black hole is released, and there's this weapon that's been designed by the Mondo G1, right? That's a nice setup, and then you kind of have the leap forward 300 years to the 23rd century, and this is when this is going to happen, and then you have to kind of the weapon has to kind of be reconstituted and brought back, and then you have that really cool idea of she gets shot down on her way back to Earth with the Mondo Chiwa, and only her hand survives, and they're able to reconstruct her using this special DNA thing. That's how
I
you kind of
genuinely
get
wish that had looked like a hand, because it looked like a Mondo Chiwan armor character. So you were expecting, when it was obviously at the time, you were expecting it to be reconstituted into something that looked that similar shape. The first 5 minutes of this are gorgeous.
Yes.
They're beautiful to look at, superbly shot. The characterization's lovely.
Yeah.
The alien design is fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
And there's issues with the design in the whole thing, because everyone just keeps saying, oh, Jean-Paul Gaultier did all of it. He didn't. Right, he did some costumes and he did some of the design, but the main designers were my favorite, and were Mobius and another guy. And and I've said this 100 times. I so wish I'd not sold my complete Mobius comics, because they were signed by him, and he's no longer with us, and they were limited edition. They were numbered as well. Oh my god! But anyway, his artwork, his designs. I was sat watching this going, that either Jean-Paul Gaultier's just ripped off an incredibly good French illustrator, or, quick, let's look it up on the internet. Oh, yes, sorry, he was involved. That's fine then. Because those taxis look exactly like something else. That version of Mega City 1. Ah, Judge Dredd was around this time as well, wasn't it? Yeah.
So, Sam, the other thing that I love about it, I guess we're scattering all around the place, is the model work.
Conversation with me.
Model work.
Yes.
Like
gorgeous.
This film kind of fits into that era where they're still working out how to use, or they're still in the sort of fledgling days of CGI, where they must have had all these conversations about, okay, what is the best way to achieve this effect?
Right. Yeah.
So you've got, okay, the big wide shots, you've got them using kind of those early particle systems to kind of do the animation for all the cars, because you can't do all the cars in model. But then for all the close-ups of the hero stuff, those are models being kind of chased around. They've obviously built the actual city itself, which is then populated with a combination of models and CG. You've got all these different kind of effects coming together, and as you said, with the insane budget that it had, they were able to afford all of those things. And yes, it's of its time, but I think it still looks good.
I think, arguably, it looks better than the second Star Wars prequel, which came a few years later.
I think that's probably true.
And as a cityscape full of cars and stuff, this just looks better. This looks more chaotic, more... And I know it is New York, and that's fine. And then there's, like, the fog level, which feels just like the Doctor Who story.
I was going to say, do you think that Russell T. Davis was at all thinking of this when he wrote Gridlock?
I know Russell's a huge fan of 2000 AD, the comic, and that was Mega City 1.
Right, okay,
That is the Mega City 1 of the 90s and 80s Judge Dredd comics. It just was. It's New York, it's the same city, it's the same location, it's the same sprawling metropolis, it's the same absolute chaos. And it's got futuristic police, only they're in cars, this one, instead of like low-giver bikes.
Yes.
You know, that are.
But there is
iconic.
There is an interesting relationship with law enforcement and.
In this.
And rough justice, I think. Shall we say?
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know,
so it's got its antecedents, yeah.
I think there's also just the world building as well.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, like Luc Besson has said, he has no interest in making a sequel, and I agree with that. Like, I don't think there's another story to tell. But at the same time, the world was an interesting world in which you could tell other very unrelated stories. You know, the fact that you've got the police come round. It reminded me of Minority Report, actually, where, you know, they send in the spiders to kind of scan people's eyes, where they kind of they come into the apartment block, and it's like they can.
Sorry, reminded you of what?
Minority Report.
Oh, Minority Report. Yes, yes.
It has that similar scene where there's a cops come in and they're trying to find a specific person in the building.
Yeah.
Obviously, Minority Report is the little spider things that go in, whereas this is like, oh, we can scan through your door as long as you've put your hands on the yellow circles. There's an element of like this society is not is not one in which I would like to live. Right? You know, you wouldn't want to live in this version of the 23rd century, right?
And his apartment, on paper, you're like, yeah, that's fine. But all the apartments are really close. They're all close to each other. They're all like hutches. But the bed disappears into the wall.
Yeah.
But that would be next door.
Yeah, exactly.
And the shower goes into the ceiling. But that would be... And then there's the fridge. And
it's one of those ones where you just kind of just don't think about it. Just don't.
Yeah. I remember, because I was a stickler for this sort of nonsense, the sort of thing that I would love now. That boat thing that turns up to sell him noodles at the window.
Yeah.
I think at the time I was just like, oh, that's ridiculous. Why would you do that? And now I'm just like, yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
I've really kind of embraced the ridiculous technology side of things.
Yes.
A bit too much. So
yeah.
I get that it's I get that it's a beautiful bit of world building. And the effects genuinely do stand up.
Yeah.
I do have... Watching it now with my daughter,
we
did... There was issues turning up which I couldn't remember happening in the first place.
Okay.
Right. Okay, for a start, I had a memory of her getting changed and everyone looking the other way.
Yeah. Right?
And the camera not actually showing the fact that she was getting changed and you could see everything.
Right. Right.
Also, when they build the body, she's there naked, all right? You're not seeing everything, but you're definitely seeing the top half. And then they put some bandages on.
Yeah.
And then the perv's like, oh, I'll just take some photographs.
So I think...
Mm-hmm. It's like, yeah, go on.
I think that is part... Well, I don't know, because obviously you saw it at the cinema, so you would have seen it. Big. I think for me, the fact that I saw it on VHS originally, because I don't remember it being that detailed either, and I think part of that is the fact that I originally saw it on VHS when I was 14, and then it was only as an adult that I saw it on Blu-ray, and then I'm like, oh yeah, actually, there is that detail there. But you having seen it at the cinema, you would have seen it all, right? Because you're watching on a big screen. So, and I think I messaged you. Did I message you about the fact that it's now a 12?
No.
So this is one. This is another of those films that has been re-rated by the BBFC about 6 years ago.
So what was it? Was it a 15?
It was a PG.
It was a PG.
Okay. This is the thing. This is how the leaders of my kids' home group were able to play it to us. You know,
under the wire.
Because it was a PG, right? So it was originally a PG. It was re-rated as a PG at some point in the 2000s, and then which was. And the Blu-ray, when the Blu-ray came out in the UK, it was still a PG. It has since been re-rated, I presume, for streaming about 6 years ago as a 12. And the specific reason given is the implied oral sex scene between Ruby Rod.
Yeah, which I've got a lot of issues with, right?
Yeah.
Because that scene with the taking off spaceship, the bit where they're loading it up with fuel, the... All of that business is just pointless, right? And then the ruby rod, well, it's not even implied. It just is. It's there. And then her legs going up and then down with the flaps of the ship.
Yes.
And you're like, mate, was your film underrunning? Did you need a bit of padding there?
No. So, okay. So, obviously the sex scene is entirely gratuitous and... unnecessary.
Pointless.
Pointless. However, the stuff with them frying the parasites and loading up the fuel, that is necessary because that is the time that you need for Cornelius to figure out how to get on board.
Oh, hang on. Right, sorry, I've got an issue with that as well. Okay, because there's a bit... No, because me and my daughter both turned to each other and went, I thought he was already on board. Because Bruce Willis's character saw Cornelius in the corridor and that was implied to be them being on board the ship.
That's
the entrance corridor to be on board the ship. Then he's shown to his bed where he goes to sleep, and then that's it. So Cornelius, in our eyes, was already on board.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, he's on the ground and has to climb inside.
Yeah.
Now, it's a spaceship. People die in ordinary aeroplanes doing that. So in a spaceship, not going to make it. And I know he ends up inside the wiring, inside the thing.
Well... I think you also have the fact that he freezes the three military people in his freezer and then they're fine later on in the film.
Yeah.
Like, I think you have to accept that there's a level of cartoon.
Yeah, but that's what's going to end up getting it a Razzie.
Yeah.
That's the end up. That's where it is. Right, okay. Effects-wise, it's going to get an Oscar for Best Looking Film, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No questions asked. Mila Jovovich, I feel, was arguably exploited, and would she have got the role if she hadn't have been willing to take her top off? And I hate stuff like that, because I really wanted to watch Game of Thrones, and we thought, you know, we'll get around to it. And then all the stuff came out about the cast feeling pressurized to be, you know, naked or whatever. Yep. And you were like, right, if the cast don't want me to watch it, I'm not going to watch it. Right.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I've become, I think, and I've been thinking about this, right? You weren't there, man. But back in the 80s, when you hired a video from the video shop, there was trailers for other movies.
Right.
Bear with me. This does make sense. And there was always a film where there was a woman who crossed her arms across it and tried to pull her top off, and it would cut to the next scene. It was like, hire this film. There's a possibility she might take her top off, right? And it was usually horror films, right? And it was usually 15s and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But that was what was implied. Yeah. It didn't happen, right? But that was what was implied, okay? Skip to later on, you get scenes like this in the film, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like you were saying, you were a teenage boy, hormones are running, you're going to be like, oh, she's quite attractive, that's going to, you know, stay with me and give me positive thoughts in my head, let's put it that way.
To be fair, actually, partly because watching on VHS, I didn't notice the detail with Mila Jovovich. There was obviously the comedy of her taking stuff off and them kind of hiding
it. And you could have completely shot it just doing the comedy and having it to one side.
I think, to be fair, what more set the hormones raging was the very revealing air hostess costumes.
Who looked exactly like they belonged on UFO, right? With less clothes. Yeah, I'll grant you that. So anyway, cut to now, where you've got, if you want it, as much people taking their tops off as you want available whenever you want it online.
Yes.
So what you're left with now is narrative where you just go, was that needed? Because people are watching films just for watching films now. They're not watching films for any of... Well, they might be watching it for the other reasons. I don't know. But there are times when I just want to go, can I watch a film now?
Yeah.
It's like, I wouldn't expect someone to take their top off in Andor or even... Well, not in Star Wars, you know what I mean? But then, of course, you've got Princess Leia in their costume from the past, so I can't really do that as an argument. But you know what? Can you see what I mean? It's like,
no, I can see
I don't
what you
mean. Need it for this story to be better.
Yeah.
Makes it slightly worse.
I think... So I agree with you, but I think the bigger problem, actually, is aside from the fight where she beats up all the Mangalores...
Yeah.
She is reduced to being this damsel in distress...
Yeah, yeah. When she's using the Encarta CD-ROM.
Yeah, yes. But yeah, I mean, that dates the film very much. But the fact that, like, she gets to have... Because obviously the narrative is split into two at that point, and you've got the fact that Bruce Willis is off with Chris Tucker blowing stuff up. And obviously we just have to forget the fact that this is supposed to be big, diehard explosions on a spaceship, because obviously the spaceship would not survive.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's put that aside.
The escape pod sequence is gorgeous.
I mean, that's lovely. That is lovely.
It's better than any film around then.
So. But the point is, the narrative is split into two. So he's doing his thing, she's doing her thing, but obviously it ends with her being wounded by Gary Oldman in the ventilation shaft and having to be rescued. And then she basically spends the rest of the film either reading from the Encarta encyclopedia, as you say, or lying in Bruce Willis's arms.
Yeah,
having to be told that he loves her so that she can activate the weapon.
Yeah.
So I think for me, the nudity feels gratuitous, and the sex feels gratuitous, and obviously it ends on the sex gag as well, which I'm not.
Which
entirely...
it felt like the really crappy ending of Moonraker. And if the camera had just gone in on the tube and then faded to black, that was better. But going to the whole blue close-up of Bruce Willis in a tube, and it's like, can we just cut that there, mate? We don't need it.
It's the fact that Christopher Fairbanks' reaction tells you all you need to know about what's going on inside, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think...
Can I just say, I do find it interesting that you've got your two big leads. There's... apparently there was like a review at the time that said there are no female characters for the first 20 odd minutes, and that's really not good. That I genuinely don't think that would happen now. But what I need to say is that Gary Oldman's character and Bruce Willis's character, although one of them's basically the good guy and the bad guy, they never meet.
They literally walk, almost walk past each
other. Yeah, one comes out of a lift, yeah. One goes into a lift, but they don't meet.
I read that they weren't even filming at the same time.
No,
I think Bruce Willis had finished before Gary Oldman started.
That's incredible.
So actually, that going back to what I said about Ian Holm, actually Ian Holm then is then the link between the two, because Ian Holm has plenty of scenes with both of them.
Yeah.
Right. The link in terms of the person who kind of links the two is him, and so in some ways he is at the heart of the film, which I like, because I love Ian Holm. I don't think I've ever seen him in anything where I haven't loved what he does.
No.
There's also the fact that, you know, there's something weird going on with his eye at the beginning.
Oh yeah, I've actually written notes on that. There's a scene where he's talking to like the president of Earth.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's got a bright red eye.
Yeah.
And you're like, did you not want to wait a few days to see if it got better, or was it worse and this is when it got better? Yeah.
I mean, it's fine. I don't...
So hang on, right. Okay. Yeah. I've got issues with Gary Oldman.
Okay.
Right. So you have to picture.
Okay. But carry on in a moment. But do you prefer Gary Oldman or Chris Tucker? Like, who annoys you more?
Oh, Chris Tucker's character by far. Apparently hired Prince.
Yes.
And the official line is Prince was busy on a tour. I think he read the script and went, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to be a caricature of myself. Even me and my daughter just went, do you think he's channeling Prince? She went, well, he's not channeling any Prince I've seen, which made sense. So
Gary Oldman. You don't like Gary Oldman,
right? No, because you have to remember what my the order of experience of Gary Oldman is, colours everything.
Okay,
he is in Sid and Nancy, yeah.
Which I've not seen, but yeah.
Which I hadn't seen. Okay, so he's done that. So that's, he gets famous for that. Okay, and he's done a few other things, which I may not have noticed him being in that film we discussed earlier. Yeah, in Leon, right? Because obviously the other characters are much more captivating and he's just generic bad guy who's a bit over the top, right? Okay, he's a bit over the top in that. Now, then he ruins a terrible film, or Dracula, as it's known to me. It's bad, and then he's in it being weird, right? So he's weird in Dracula. He's really weird in... Lost in Space. So by this point in my life,
Lost in Space was the year after this.
Oh, well, he's terrible in that. Okay. So are you sure? Because I was living in Manchester then. Oh, God, his time just fleeted by.
I'm pretty sure Lost in Space was 98.
Now, I remember Lost in Space being fantastic for the first half hour because we'd been doing tequila shots before we went in the cinema. And as the tequila wore off, the film got worse. And he was terrible. So I never, ever liked Gary Oldman. It was one of those, if he's in a film, I'll just kind of not bother.
Oh, interesting.
And then I watched Slow Horses. And I'd avoided it for like 3 years. Like, I missed the first three seasons. I'm like, oh, well, there's nothing on. We'll give it a go. Everyone says we'll like it. And he's brilliant in that. Slow Horses is a magnificent piece of TV making.
Okay. Hang on a minute. Did you not watch the Christopher Nolan Batman films?
No, oh, yeah, I'd forgot. I forgot he was.
You forgot that he was Commissioner Gordon.
I forgot he was Commissioner Gordon. Yeah, I think that's possibly what allowed me to watch these ones. I went, oh, he must have toned it down. I think that was it. But also, my Commissioner Gordon in my head is the one from Gotham, because I really loved the Gotham TV series.
Right.
And not just because of Sean Pertwee, it was just very good. So yeah, I've got it. But anyway, so yeah, I did watch. I only saw those two or three times.
Because I suspect that most people hold him in higher regard than you do. Then.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But I mean, he was camping a bit weird in this. He was camping a bit weird in lots of other films that I happen to have seen him in.
Right.
And it was as if he was a caricature, and he'd made money being that. So he never He never got round to learning how to act properly. And that was from my experience of his films.
Yeah.
And I was, it was like, oh, every time I saw a bad film that we had him in, I kind of pegged them together and it wasn't. And then if he was good in a film, I just didn't notice.
I mean, I have to say that I, in the same way that I didn't realise that Dustin Hoffman was Hook for years.
Yes.
I never really thought about this as being Gary Oldman until years later. I went, oh yeah, it's Gary Oldman. Because as I said, I think I wasn't really paying attention to who actors were in this other than ones I already knew, i.e. Ian Holm. And obviously I didn't, I don't think, we'll get to it later with Spot the Doctor Who actor, but because most of the people who were in Doctor Who after this. The one notable exception, I don't think I'd seen his performances in Classic Who when I saw this, so I definitely didn't make the connection at the time. Here's the question, right? Did you come out of the film having enjoyed it, or were the problems just too much?
The problems were much bigger than I was expecting.
Right.
Chris Tucker did a lot of damage.
Right.
The stewardesses, and the fact that she became such a damsel in distress like at the end as well.
Yeah.
It just didn't feel as, it didn't feel as good as I remembered it being.
Right.
And I felt bad about that because I was like, oh yeah, this is great. And I'm watching it with my daughter going, oh, a little bit embarrassed about this, but you know, and she's like, well, it didn't go down as well as it could have. She was like, thanks for making us watch that, Dad. Yeah.
I think that's the thing.
But it was fine. It was perfectly fine as a film. It made me go, oh, I remembered it being better, but I was watching it going, that was fantastic. The opera scene, I remember at the time not enjoying a huge amount and just thinking, oh, they're just good. Part of that was filmed in London at the National Opera.
I feel that there's a weird moment of direction at the end which slightly spoils it.
Right, what is it?
Because for the whole performance, the curtains are open.
Yeah.
And they've clearly blue screened or green screened in the planet that they're flying over, right?
Yeah.
And the way that it's shot.
Oh my God! Sorry.
Cut together.
It's a holiday world, the Flotsam Angel Paradise.
Yeah.
That they never land on. Flying to Florida.
Yeah.
Where Disney is, and then going on a Disney cruise.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they're on a ship in orbit. Exactly. And you're like, we'll have a better time on the planet.
But I feel that like that vista behind her is what makes that whole sequence.
They bothered themselves to bothering to put a reflection of the boxes onto the back screen so you knew it was some sort of glass.
So that's
a lesser performance would not have done that.
And the fact that you've then got her performance soundtracking Leeloo.
Yeah.
Intercut that really, really works. And then at the very end, you cut to a wide shot, the curtains come across, and you're like, oh, I'm in an opera house on Earth. Right? Yeah. Because suddenly the space vista is gone. You've cut to the wide shot, and you're like, you've just, with that one shot, you've broken the illusion that we're in space.
Mm.
And it's the last shot of the performance. So I was like, oh, you know, it didn't quite work. And I can see. From the rest of it, because they then have a load more scenes with the Mangalores kind of trying to find them. I'm like, okay, I can see why you closed the curtains from a practical point of view because you didn't want to do any more space shots.
Yeah,
but you know, it was like, visually you've just broken it.
Right, that performer. The blue character. Stick with characters. Skinny.
Yes.
Plava
Laguna. Yes.
Okay, the diva. Where did the diva have the stones?
Inside her tummy.
Which was like, there was very little tummy.
I mean, there's also the kind of weird thing of like, she clearly wasn't planning to get shot, right? The only reason he's able to get the stones out of her is because she's been mortally wounded.
Are we thinking that they're in some sort of pouch like a kangaroo?
I don't know. I mean, they're covered in her blood.
Let's go with that.
Yeah, it's weird. It's weird. It's like, yes, I'm going to smuggle the stones in. Yeah. It's like smuggling cocaine in condoms in your intestine, right? Isn't it? That people do.
And we're going to move on.
I just remember seeing, you know, one of those like airport. It was called airport, wasn't it?
Can I just say, right? Oh no, no, no. Right. On you don't have Sky TV. There's a channel on Sky TV that's got Border Force Australia. Now, Border Force is that program? Is that kind of program you're talking about? Yeah. Border Force is on all the time. All the time. You can find that channel and you'll just put it on and you'll go, oh, it's another Australian Border Force where we're trying not to be racist. However, I mean, and then it does that and it's brilliant. So, yes. But my favourite one is somebody making a garden gnome out of meth crystals. So that's the ongoing thing in our house. If somebody's trying to smuggle something, they're going, yeah, it's good, but is it a garden gnome made out of meth?
Right? Wow. Yeah. Wow.
It's a great.
Was it just called Airport? It was narrated by John Nettles.
I think so. That was.
I think
that
that's
was,
what it was. Yeah. I think there was an episode where somebody had basically been had been in Colombia, probably. Yeah. It might be stereotyped, but I think Colombia had basically
and
swallowed.
It's condoms with other condoms.
Swallowed condoms full of cocaine,
or not swallowed.
And it was all this thing of like, you know, it's a really dangerous thing to do because one of those bursts in your intestine and you're dead.
Then you're very dead.
Yeah. Anyway, so yes, so she's got the stones inside her. I think. If that's your only problem with the science in the film, then...
Oh, it's not. It's not, but let's not bother going down that list. It's going to be a huge list, really, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, yeah. I think I still enjoyed it.
Does the film now... Sorry, because I know you've looked up like what certificate it is. Does it now come with, this film contains smoking as a warning?
Oh, interesting. I don't think that was listed on the BBFC.
Because obviously it's a major part of the plot. I love the cigarettes with their old filter and a tiny little cigarette. I did like that even
at
the time.
That's interesting, actually, because obviously...
Because he has to smoke in order to have fire.
Yes.
At the end for the element.
Yes,
otherwise
exactly.
It makes no sense narrative. Because otherwise you're sat there going, what? Why is this futuristic person smoking? But yeah.
That's interesting, yeah, as I said, because Atlantis now says, you know, smoking.
Yeah.
But this one didn't. I mean, I love visually. I love that whole kind of like quit smoking, and the filter is like three quarters of the cigarette. You know, I thought that was quite a funny visual gag.
Oh yeah.
And yeah, the fact that he's got like
so,
this box.
Let's
of
have
matches.
A quick Luc Besson-y chat. Okay, so the time when Luc arrives in this country, he's done Subway with Christopher Lambert, and he's done Nikita, and then there's Leon, right, and then there's The Fifth Element. That's a pretty strong arc. Okay. And then
of those, I've only seen The Fifth Element.
And then, well, I'll tell you what, Leon's great. Nikita is better than the remake, but the remake's not bad. And then it starts getting a bit weird if you go on IMDb, because there's a bit of a Jason Statham direction thing going
on.
Yes,
I read about
and
this.
He also starts, he writes Taken 3, and he does Taken's The Slippery Slope. Right, because you go, oh, I can do action, because he can do action, because he's done Leon, he's done some other action stuff. Nikita's full action, right? But then he starts getting a bit hammy as well, and then Jason Statham turns up, and then you start, and there's very little sci-fi. And I know there's Adele Belair, and it's a bit steam. There's a steampunk one where she's riding a dinosaur, which I do own, but I've never got around to seeing because I've got to be in the mood for reading subtitles. Because that one's just in French.
Right.
Okay, but... And then in his modern stuff, there's like, he does Nikita, the TV series. And basically his career is in reverse. He does these storming, earth-shattering movies at the beginning. It's as if Quentin Tarantino went, I want to make episodes of SWAT. It feels like that. It's just blatantly weird.
Have you seen his more recent sci-fi, Valerian?
Yes. Oh, I forgot all about that. It looked fantastic. Well, it looked... Oh, hang on. Is that the one where Sean Bean doesn't die? And that's the twist?
I don't...
Is that Battle Angel?
I don't remember Sean Bean being it. It's the guy from...
Is that the Jupiter one?
That could be the Jupiter one. No, it's It's I forget who's in it. Anyway, I agree with you. It looked beautiful, and the plot was awful. And my wife and I watched it, and we were because we. I think well, this is an interesting thing. I was going to watch The Fifth Element with Hannah because I said, "Do you want to watch it with me?" And she said yes. And then she had a migraine 2 days in a row, and so she couldn't watch it with me. And I would be interested to know what her commentary would have been, but I can't give you her current thoughts. I think she would have had the same issues with The Fifth Element now watching it again. But we watched Valerian because we both were like, well, we like The Fifth Element. Let's see what this is. And it was just... Mm. Or I can't even remember what the plot was, but I just remember us coming away from...
I'm pretty sure that's the one about some people being reincarnated and your soul...
There's a whole kind of like where they're in two dimensions at once, and so they have to kind of walk in a certain way, and then you see it visually from two different perspectives. That's all I remember about it.
I think I watched it when it was on ages ago, but I think, well, see, now I'm just thinking I want to watch Battle Angel, because that was a really good film, but that has nothing to do with this. This is the other film I thought you were talking about.
No, I that Battle Angel.
Oh my God, if ever there was a film that deserved a sequel. That one's great, and I think they should just make Ready Player 2 as well. But they're just my
are
two films.
Are they not
films
making Ready Player 2?
Oh, I do hope so, because it's been...
I think that's somewhere written on the slate.
Oh, I do hope so. Anyway, right. So, I've gone through my notes. I'll stick with it. I love the opening first 5 minutes. You can't beat those. It's a beautiful setup.
Yeah.
I love aliens in 1915. Egypt is gorgeous, right?
Which is actually Madagascar, apparently.
Yeah. I just love that. And then, yeah. Shall we have a quick chat about cast?
Well,
yeah.
So, I reckon...
Hang on. Can I just say, opening credits, Luke Perry. And you're like, oh, Luke Perry's in this.
And he's in
He's
like...
quite famous. And yeah. He's in it for 20 seconds.
He's in it very shortly. And then died very young, apparently.
Okay.
So, there are, by my count, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 Doctor Who actors. But,
I did not get them.
Well, but I would only expect you to get 3. And we texted back and forth, and you had indeed got the 3 that I expected you to get. So, give us the 3, Michael, that you spotted, and I will then tell you why you didn't spot the rest.
Right. Christopher Fairbank is in Modern Doctor Who as the man who can see the psychic paper as a piece of paper because he has no imagination. It's the episode where they shrink the Doctor down to TARDIS and there's a hand and it's like thing and yeah. What's the episode
Flatline.
Called? Flatline. There you go. So I remember it being good.
It is good, yes. It's one of the most recent Peter Capaldi's that I've rewatched, i.e. sometime in the last year or
it's
two.
It's about the series where I suddenly lost interest. it's more or less at this point where I go, is Doctor Who for me anymore? And I'm yet to hear an answer that isn't Big Finish is for me.
Yes.
Okay.
So he plays the scientist who reconstitutes Miljovovich.
He played Moxie in Alveda's Implant, and more recently, he's also Old Man in Series 1 of Andor. And his performance is incredibly good.
And he's also the collector in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I think he's called the collector. He basically has a bunch of artifacts and somebody goes to buy some. I think he's in Guardians of the Galaxy and then he turns up again.
Oh, I didn't think he was the collector at all.
I'm pretty sure that's him.
I thought he was one of the aliens who can shape change. They're like frog people. And it was the whole Invasion Earth thing, but he was in the film. It doesn't matter.
Anyway,
so he's one of these people. No, he can do Marvel. He's done Marvel, Doctor Who, and Star Wars.
Yes.
So you only need to do Trek, and he's got more. Which, you know what, he might have done. There'll be somebody listening going, he's definitely done that. And finally, the one that I definitely spotted, Lee Evans. Now, here's the thing. Lee Evans is wearing a sailor costume in this, designed by Jean-Paul Gaultier, which is exactly the same as the one that Jean-Paul Gaultier perfume advert, because he did one set of designs back in the 90s and went, that's it, I'm done now. Tore off the page in his design book and went, we'll have that one there. Now, I had a love-hate relationship with Lee Evans and I never really liked him. And then my wife went, you're wrong. And she made me watch some stand-up and I was wrong. But I don't like the fact that he never came back to Doctor Who.
Well, he hasn't done any acting since Doctor Who.
Exactly.
If you look on IMDb, that's his last acting credit. Because I think he's one of these people that kind of is quite reclusive when he's not doing his stand-up, right?
Well, he hasn't done any stand-up for... He retired from everything.
Yeah.
But I'm pretty sure he'll come back because the guy's frenetic. He can't help himself.
I mean, I've only seen short clips of him being bonkers on stage, and I'm just like, that's not my kind of comedy. And so I haven't,
no. Right, what you have to do is you have to get through. This is how she explained it to me. You have to get through the first 10 minutes.
Right.
That's when he's too nervous. He comes out and he's got to get rid of his nervous energy.
Right.
Once he's past that point, he starts telling actual gags.
Right.
And then he's hilarious.
Okay.
Or just watch the Bohemian Rhapsody sketch where he does it mime, and that's enough.
Okay.
So if you don't like Lee Evans, watch that. You'll like Lee Evans. Okay, that's
okay.
It.
Okay. And then
were the three I've... Oh, no, hang on.
We've
sorry.
Just done two. Who's the third one?
It's the bloke at the beginning who's of swarthy Asian persuasion, who of course isn't, and he is the general out of talk. He's all right. It's Talanza Wen Chiang Man.
Yes, it is Talanza Wen Chiang Man.
Everyone was Talanza Wen Chiang fighting,
and also, as you said, the general in Invasion of the Dinosaurs, where yes. he's not playing somebody of a questionable ethnicity.
Spin the wheel of ethnicity, yeah. Well, to be fair, Roger Delgado, you know,
Roger Delgado is a whole other conversation that I once half had with somebody online, and they said we should not carry on this conversation, and so I was like, okay, we won't.
You see, there are people listening going, please tell us more. Okay, so they were the ones. Is that it? Are they the ones?
So those are the three that I expected you to find, because all the rest are either very small parts, or they're covered in latex.
Yeah.
Both in Doctor Who in this.
Okay, so my brain was racking, going, are we sure Ian Holm never did a Doctor Who, ever?
No.
And I was like, no, he didn't. And then there was the woman from Lives and Loves of a She-Devil, whose name I always forget, and she's a very good performer. But she was with Tom Baker in that.
Right.
And she turns up as the person who's going to be Bruce Willis's wife on the secret mission.
Right.
And I was convinced in my head that she'd been in Doctor Who at some point.
All I can say is that at the time she was in Last of the Summer Wine, which is where I recognised her from.
Okay then, right.
Anyway,
right. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is the difference in our generation and age.
There we go. Let's run through them. So, the President's aide, played by Sunita Henry, so the woman who just kind of stands behind him and doesn't say much.
Okay.
Played a colonel in Time of the Doctor and got one of those Dalek eye stalks coming out of her head.
Ah, yes. Terrible.
John Hughes played the head of the military. I don't know which military person he was. He wasn't one of the ones who had much to say. Was apparently an uncredited reporter in Spearhead from Space. So again, that's why you didn't recognise him.
Okay.
Richard Ashton was one of the Munda Chiwen. So in those delightful costumes that we talked about. He was the character of Friday in The Empress of Mars. So again, you wouldn't have recognised him.
Nope.
Alan Rusko was one of the Mangalores. He was later an Auton and a Slitheen and the android.
Man in costume replaces man in costume.
Ah, but then his final appearance in Doctor Who was Andy Stone in The Waters of Mars, the first guy who gets turned into a flood monster. So you did actually get to see him in Doctor Who once with his real face. Then you had Sean Buckley, who was a scientist and a barman in The Wedding of Riversong. No guesses as to who he was in either of those. Now, last one, Sonny Caldinez.
No information.
You know who he is in Doctor Who, though, right?
No.
Okay, so in this, he was the Emperor Kodar Japhet, and I don't know why he's credited, because he doesn't say anything. He's the guy that Chris Tucker points to and then kind of plays the clip of his daughter in intimate circumstances.
Yeah. Okay,
So him. So he's like in the back of like two shots in the upper scene. So he was Kemmel in The Evil of the Daleks, and he was an ice warrior in all four classic ice warrior stories.
Got you. Right. I should have known that, and I apologise to everyone listening.
Now, we also said there's a Red Dwarf actor who I know that you spotted immediately.
Yeah, it's the captain of the dwarf. He was playing the policeman who got his McDonald's spilt.
Yes, who I just thought was hilarious in this. Did you recognise the professor at the beginning of the film?
Yes, he's the bloke from Dawn French thing.
Vicar Dibley. Yeah.
He's the man. Yeah, but he's got the single best scene in the whole of the Vicar Dibley, where, because he's the world's most boring man, and he goes on Radio Dibley, right, as a DJ, and everyone's meant to be listening in, and he comes out of the closet as being gay, right?
Right.
On like local radio and tells everyone, and it's a beautifully, beautifully performed scene, right? And the joke is, no one's listening.
No one's listening.
But he comes in the next day as if everyone was already knowing and they're all really accepting of him. And he behaves exactly the same as he always has, but he's just happier. Because he now thinks everyone knows.
Everyone knows.
And it's absolutely the best writing Curtis ever did. Right? It's great. It's a superb piece of... And it's a throwaway. It's hardly in it. But I remember at the time being, oh my God, that's a gorgeous performance. And then the payoff in the next scene is even better. It's just so touching. It's brilliant. He's great.
Well, so he was also a regular voice in Fireball XL5.
Well, there you go.
And he's one of the people that Tony Hancock talks to in the Radio Ham.
It always comes back to the Radio Ham.
And then the last one we have to talk about is
yep.
The technician who helps Christopher Fairbank was played by Anthony Chin. And if we go all the way back to the UFO cast, Anthony Chin played Lieutenant Chin in one episode, you know, where he in the submarine where he goes a bit mad.
There you go, that's Gerry Anderson for you. And then what should we call this character?
And then he also
what do you
played...
call Jeff? Is it Jeff? Let's call this character
Let's
Jeff.
Call him Jeff. Yeah. And then he played an alien as well in UFO.
Right.
So, you know, that's there's no doubt other people to spot, but those are the ones that
there was, yeah.
It's, well, it's a massive credited cast. It's like over 100 people yeah. credited in the cast. It's insane.
The captain of the ship at the beginning, the one who launches all the missiles at the planet
yes.
for no reason. Was yeah. it, I have my doubts, and he goes, I don't.
I don't.
And then he gets the black ink coming down his head.
Yes.
He's been in loads of stuff. And I was very, very sure he'd been in Doctor Who. I was, or even Torchwood. I was thoroughly convinced. But I know he was a recurring character in The X-Files.
Right.
And he was, but I think he also plays, because I am down as Richard Herndl for 2 minutes. But,
he does look a bit like Richard Herndl. Though Richard Herndl had been dead for like 12 years.
Well, there is that. But yeah, he was in The X-Files a lot.
Right.
Not as he was a kind of, when you thought the cigarette smoking man was dead, he became the new villain.
So I have no real experience with The X-Files.
I might have to put that on the list because I did my dissertation on The X-Files. It was only at season 3 at the time because I don't learn. I never learn. Right. Okay. So I'm glad you brought it and I'm glad I experienced it again. I am.
But you're not going to watch it again after this.
No, I can't see it happening for a long time. But that's all right. It's not the end of the world. I've got plenty of other things to watch. My list of things to watch is gigantic.
Are you beginning to wish that you had chosen the 1990s TV show set in the 1920s of a comedic bent, which was my other suggestion last time?
Which I still haven't worked out what it is.
It's fine. We will do that next time. We'll do that next time when it's my choice.
Right.
What's your choice for next time, Michael?
Okay, now I've been humming and ahhing about this. I've almost given this one a few times, and then I've gone, no. The reason is because there's a few films that are so close to your own heart, like you with the Chariots of Fire,
yeah.
that you're like, I don't want to pull this up to the light just in case.
Right.
Right, just in case it's... But the film is being remade, and it's the 40th anniversary of this film coming out. And it's Highlander.
Oh, okay.
Right. It's the original Highlander, because when I saw Highlander 2, I stood up in the cinema and shouted, there should have been only one. And I got a clap. Okay. So we're just watching the first one. We're going to ignore the existence of anything else.
Right.
Including the TV series. I know some people will kick off. But it's just Highlander 1.
So I have heard Staggering Stories talk about Highlander every so often in positive terms.
Yes.
So, yes, and I know that there's only supposed to be one, and it's some kind of, like, sci-fi sword...
I will not spoil it anymore. Okay. Don't look up anything. Just enjoy watching it.
Okay.
Because, or don't. Either way, it'll give us stuff to chat about. But there is a 4K release coming out quite soon. That's
right.
Got a massive book, which, of course, I would love to have read, but I can't. So, but I know, it's got a huge place in my heart. There's like this, there's Blade Runner, there's a few other films that are just like,
Who is the Highlander?
Christopher Lambert from Subway with Luc Besson.
Does he then turn up in...
Tarzan with Ian Holm.
I know the name Christopher Lambert, but I'm not sure what I would have seen him in. Anyway, I'd look him up.
There's a chess film he does as well.
Okay.
But you might have seen Tarzan with Ian Holm.
No, I haven't.
Okay, well, in that.
Are there any Doctor Who actors to spot in Highlander?
I don't know. There's a big British cast, but it's mainly New York, but it's one of those... I will have a think, and I will look it up. Off the top of my head, I can't... Oh, yes, God, yes, of course, there's at least one. And you'll go... Sorry, there's one, and you'll go, how's she in this?
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah, because you'll... I think she's got, like, two lines, but you're like, how's she got two lines? What's going on here?
Talking a Doctor Who companion?
No.
Okay.
No.
A prominent guest star.
Yes, she's a prominent guest star, and you'll go, right, but you'll know her from everything else in the world.
Interesting, okay.
She's done more telly than you can shake a stick at. She's national treasure level. But in this, you're like, whoa, what's going on? Eh? How's she in this?
Okay.
So yeah, there's at least one that's there, yeah.
Okay.
But anyway, I shall sort out getting you that, or if you can see if you can source it yourself, we'll deal with that afterwards. But either way, Highlander is next time, because I want to get it out of the way so we can get on with talking about really bad TV sci-fi again, like we used to. And I've got a list of that as well. To be fair, right, I have actually been considering, and I haven't got this on the list at the minute, but there's a Gareth Thomas sci-fi series that was made by, it was a co-production with Germany, and it's a bit like the Dravids, where the women are in charge on this alien world, and he's on the run and ends up on Earth.
Right.
And I got it on DVD, and I think I've watched half of one episode, and it's appalling. And I'm thinking that was the sort of thing I was going to bring, but probably not that one. Okay, so yeah, let's leave that. Next time it's Highlander, and it's all going to be all right.
Great. Okay. Cool. Well, I thank you for watching The Fifth Element and bringing yours and your daughter's perspective. I appreciate it. I still enjoyed it.
Oh, no, it was good. I enjoyed it.
I can now see its flaws.
I enjoyed about 97%. The 3% irritated the hell out of me, but the 97% of it was fine. Perfectly good. Right? So, yeah, I did not enjoy this.
Yeah,
by far.
Yeah,
but that's it. Yeah, okay. But next time, Highlander.
Next time, Highlander. Cool. Well, thank you very much again, Michael. And I will leave things as ever to you.
Be seeing you.